Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Isaiah chapter 36, which I will entitle Sennacherib Invades Judah. And now we have reached a section in Isaiah which covers historical events. We won't have any prophecy now for several chapters. And this concerns the invasion of King Sennacherib of Assyria, who invaded Judah in 701 B.C. So we start now in Isaiah 36, 1 through 3. In the 14th year of King Hezekiah, he reigned from 716 to 687 B.C. In the 14th year of King Hezekiah's reign, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, attacked all the fortified cities of Judah and captured them. Then the king of Assyria sent his field commander with a large army from Lachish to King Hezekiah at Jerusalem. When the commander stopped at the aqueduct of the upper pool on the road to the washerman's field, Eliakim, son of Hilkiah, the palace administrator, Shebna, the secretary, and Joah, the son of Asaph, the recorder, went out to him. Now here's a little bit of introduction here from John Gill. This following piece of history is inserted from the books of Kings and Chronicles as an illustration of some preceding prophecies and as a confirmation of them. You recall, as we've gone through Isaiah, many of the prophecies have been against Assyria, and now we have some history of how those prophecies were fulfilled. Now, if we look back at the historical books, we see in 2 Kings 18:13, in the 14th year of King Hezekiah, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, attacked all the fortified cities of Judah and captured them. And then in 2 Chronicles 32:1, parallel passage, after these faithful deeds, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came and entered Judah. He laid siege to the fortified cities and intended to break into them. Now, we have a little bit of a harmonization issue here. In Kings, 2 Kings 18:13, Sennacherib captured the fortified cities of Judah. And in 2 Chronicles 32:1, he intended to break into them. How do you reconcile that intention with the actual capture? Here's two options. Sennacherib carried out his intention later. So in 2 Chronicles 32:1, he intended to break into them, and he did it later on. That would harmonize it. Or you could harmonize it this way. Sennacherib didn't capture every city in Judah that he besieged. All can sometimes mean a great many of. So this happened in verse 1 in the 14th year of King Hezekiah's reign. If you take 716 when he started to reign minus 14, you get 702, which of course is close enough. When you consider that you're dealing with partial years at the beginning and end of your subtraction. Now let me give you some more of the historical background. This comes from Bible Guide, answers.com. Quote, after the death of Sargon in 705, that's Sargon II of Assyria, Hezekiah joined the rebellion against Assyria initiated by Merodach-Baladan of Chaldea with the support of Egypt. Now this says, with the support of Egypt, I'm going to point out that I'm not really sure that Hezekiah actually engaged in an alliance with Egypt. I know he thought about it. And Merodach-Baladan is the king of Babylonia, which was not an empire yet. It was just a rebellious province in the empire of Assyria. So Sennacherib takes over in 705. Hezekiah prepared for the worst by building up the fortifications of Jerusalem and ensuring its water supply by digging a tunnel from the Gihon Spring to the Siloam Pool inside the walls of the city. Sennacherib entered Judah in 701 and boasted of capturing 46 cities, including Lachish, and deporting 200,150 captives. But Jerusalem held fast, and the siege of the city was raised after the Assyrian army was decimated by disease, killing 185,000 Assyrians. This is in 2 Kings 19:35 and Isaiah 37:36. And Hezekiah paid a large tribute. After Hezekiah's death, Judah remained a vassal of Assyria, and pagan shrines were restored. Now let's talk about Sennacherib a little bit from the same source, Bible Guide, answers.com. Tiglath-Pileser III, called in the scriptures Pul, P-U-L, he ruled from 745 to 727, and his successor was Shalmaneser V, who ruled 727 to 722. Shalmaneser V laid siege for 3 years against Samaria when Hoshea, king of Israel, backed by Egypt, rebelled against Assyria. At the end of the siege, Samaria capitulated. Hoshea capitulated. He's king of northern Israel now, the capital of which was Samaria in the province of Ephraim, and Hoshea was taken prisoner. Apparently, Shalmaneser V died or was murdered during the siege, and his successor, Sargon, II completed the conquest of the city. Now, this Sargon II, he reigned from 722 from the fall of Samaria, the northern kingdom, to 705 BC. He was one of the chief architects of the late Assyrian Empire and the founder of its greatest line of kings. Now, Sennacherib reigned from 705 to 681. He was one of the four great kings of the late Assyrian Empire. He rebuilt Nineveh and destroyed Babylon. So this Sennacherib attacked Egypt. His ultimate object was to get to Egypt, which perhaps was Hezekiah's ally, although I cannot prove that for certain. I'll talk about that a little bit later. It could be just because I don't have a deep enough knowledge of the history here. But Sennacherib was trying to get to Egypt, and Israel was in the way. So he advanced towards the Egyptian frontier, and he went around Jerusalem. His object was not Jerusalem. His object was Egypt, and so he ended up in southwest Palestine on the way to Egypt, and he started attacking a bunch of fortified cities down there, one of which was Lachish. We read in 2 Chronicles 32:9, after this, while Sennacherib, king of Assyria, with all his armed forces, besieged Lachish, he sent his servants to Jerusalem against King Hezekiah of Judah and against all those of Judah who were in Jerusalem. And then the story continues, which we will continue also in just a little bit. Now, Sennacherib attacked the cities of Judah, but not all of them, according to one of my commentators. Now, verse 1 says, Sennacherib attacked all the fortified cities of Judah. Sometimes that word all can mean a great many of it. It doesn't necessarily mean all without exception. And he captured them. So Hezekiah and Judah were in deep doo-doo. Verse 2, then the king of Assyria sent his field commander. That's Rabshakeh. The NIV just gets rid of the Assyrian and calls it field commander, but I like Rabshakeh better. The word means chief cupbearer. It's not a proper name. It's a title, an official title. Jigil says of this, notwithstanding he, that's Sennacherib, had taken Hezekiah's money to withdraw his army out of the country, yet sends it out to his very capital. Along with this, Rabshakeh, he sent two other generals, Tartan and Rabsaris, though they are not mentioned here, only Rabshakeh, because he was the principal person, however, the chief speaker. Tartan and Rabsaris are also titles and not proper names. Now, Sennacherib did not leave his siege of Lachish to go up to Jerusalem to speak to King Hezekiah personally. Sennacherib instead sent his three officials, the Rabshakeh, the Tartan, and the Rabsaris. They stopped at the aqueduct of the upper pool outside of Jerusalem. Now, I'm going to talk about my understanding of where this upper pool was and the associated pool of Siloam. I will tell you that the archaeology, the scholarship concerning the geography of where these pools are is enough to drive one insane because it is confusing and contradictory. But this is the best way I can understand it. The upper pool was the pool fed by the spring of Gihon, G-I-H-O-N. Sometimes it's pronounced Jihon, apparently, but I'm going to call it Gihon or Jihon, Gihon. It was located on the slope that runs down from the city of David in Jerusalem down to the Kidron Valley to the east of Jerusalem, about halfway up that slope, part of the way from the southern to the northern tip of the city of David. And from that upper pool, the Pool of Gihon, today called the Virgin's Pool, there was a conduit that ran down the side of that hill and then to the very tip of the city of David, right where the Tyrrhenian Valley and the Kidron Valley and the Hinnom Valley intersect. In that area was a lower pool called the Pool of Siloam. Hezekiah built a tunnel from the upper pool to the lower pool, from the spring of Gihon down to the Pool of Siloam. That tunnel is still in existence today for all the tourists who go to Jerusalem to see it. The purpose that drove Hezekiah to build such a tunnel, he wanted to get that spring of water under the walls of Jerusalem, and underground, actually, so that the attacking Assyrians, the besieging Assyrians, could not get to the water and stop up the water supply and put the citizens of Jerusalem in a bad way. So it was an underground spring, underground tunnel, ran from the Pool of Gihon down to the Pool of Siloam, which was within the walls. Now, outside the walls in the Kidron's Valley, probably, is the Washerman's Field. The other translations have the Fuller's Field, because a fuller washed wool clothes, and a fuller would need water, so it makes sense that the field was outside near the Gihon Spring in the Kidron Valley somewhere. Now, again, people have argued over where the fuller's field is too, so I'm not going to be too precise about that. And it's not in the field itself, but it's on the road to the field where the Rabshakeh stood outside the walls of Jerusalem. Now, as I said earlier, the Rabshakeh shouldn't be there outside of Jerusalem because Hezekiah had paid a lot of money to Assyria in order to get them to stop the siege. Didn't do any good. We read in 2 Kings 18, verses 14 through 16, "So Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent word to the king of Assyria at Lachish, saying, 'I have done wrong. Withdraw from me. Whatever you demand from me, I will pay.' The king of Assyria demanded 11 tons of silver and 1 ton of gold from King Hezekiah of Judah. So Hezekiah gave Sennacherib all the silver found in the Lord's temple and in the treasuries of the king's palace." That's a huge tribute. A lot of money. 11 tons of silver and 1 ton of gold. "At that time Hezekiah stripped the gold from the doors of the Lord's sanctuary and from the doorpost he had overlaid and gave it to the king of Assyria." So basically, Hezekiah despoiled the glory of Jerusalem and the glory of the temple in order to pay off this jerk. And Sennacherib took the money and then said, "I'm going to come after you anyway, Hezekiah." Now Sennacherib was at Lachish, as I said. And this is what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say about Lachish. It was a frontier town southwest of Jerusalem in Judah, represented as a great fortified city in a hilly and fruitful country in a certain bas-relief now in the British Museum. Also, Lachish is found on a slab over a figure of Sennacherib on his throne. So Lachish shows up in archaeology. And going back to the upper pool, I'm going to quote you from the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, which backs up my conception of what was involved here. Quote, now this is true even though internet sources have put that pool all over the place, the upper pool, the Gihon Spring. Well, here's what ISBE says, International Standard Bible Encyclopedia. "The most probable view is that this conduit was one connected with Gihon, the present Virgin's Fountain. This was well known as the Upper Spring. And the pool, which we know was at the source, would probably be called the Upper Pool." So ISBE backs me up on what I said earlier. "In this neighborhood, or lower down the valley near En-Rogel," En-Rogel was south of the city of David in the Kidron Valley, even south of the Valley of Hinnom. So the Fuller's Field could be that far south, but or it could be further up the valley in the Kidron Valley, further north. But this is the natural place to expect fulling because you need water to wash clothes. "So somewhere along the Kidron Valley between the Virgin's Fountain," that's the Pool of Gihon, "and the junction with the Tyropean," that's where the Tyropean and the Kidron came together at the tip of the city of David, "was the probable scene of the interview with Rabshakeh." And that's what I'm going with. Now, three officials were involved in the negotiations with the Rabshakeh. In verse 3, Isaiah 36, the first was Eliakim, son of Hilkiah. He's called the palace administrator. The second was Shebna, the secretary. Now, this presents a little problem because back in Isaiah 22, Shebna was the palace administrator, not Eliakim. So let's go back and take a look at Isaiah 22, verses 15 through 21. "The Lord God of hosts said, 'Go to Shebna, that steward who is in charge of the palace.'" See, he's a steward now. He's the palace steward in Isaiah 22. In Isaiah 36, he's the secretary. "Go to Shebna, that steward who is in charge of the palace, and say to him, 'What are you doing here? Who authorized you to carve out a tomb for yourself here, carving your tomb on the height and cutting a crypt for yourself out of a rock?'" That, of course, was sort of arrogant. That's what kings did. "Look, you strong man, the Lord is about to shake you violently. He will take hold of you, wind you up into a ball and sling you into a wide land. There you will die, and there your glorious chariots will be, a disgrace to the house of your Lord. I will remove you from your office. You will be ousted from your position. On that day I will call for my servant Eliakim, son of Hilkiah. I will clothe him with your robe and tie your sash around him. I will put your authority into his hand, and he will be like a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and to the house of Judah.'" So in Isaiah 22, Eliakim prophesied by Isaiah, Eliakim is going to take Shebna's place. So we have a problem here. Isaiah prophesies in Isaiah 22 that Eliakim will replace Shebna, but in Isaiah 36:3, Eliakim and Shebna are in office at the same time. Also, another problem is in Isaiah 22:15, Shebna is the palace steward, but in Isaiah 36:3, Shebna is the secretary. So how do we solve this problem? Well, you could say that the Shebna in Isaiah 22 and the Shebna in Isaiah 36 are different people. I don't think so. The other option is to say that Shebna was demoted from steward, which he was in Isaiah 22, to secretary, which he was in Isaiah 36. And this happened right before Sennacherib's attack. And after he was demoted, Hezekiah put Eliakim, son of Hilkiah, in Shebna's old office. And so now Eliakim is steward, palace steward, and Shebna is a mere secretary. That's the easiest way to reconcile that. So, going back to verse 3 of Isaiah 36, Eliakim, son of Hilkiah, the palace administrator, the palace steward, he's the new palace steward, taken over from the old palace steward, Shebna. Shebna, the secretary, his new job, a demotion, and a third official called Joah, son of Asaph, the recorder. The recorder is probably the chronicler, the historian of the reign, the historiographer. Now, to keep things simple from now on, I'm just going to call these three the three Jewish officials. We go down to Isaiah 36, verses 4 through 7. The field commander, that's Rabshakeh, said to them, the three Jewish officials, tell Hezekiah, this is what the great king, the king of Assyria, that's Sennacherib, says. On what are you basing this confidence of yours? You say you have strategy and military strength, but you speak only empty words. On whom are you depending that you rebel against me? Look now, you are depending on Egypt, that splintered reed of a staff, which pierces a man's hand and wounds him if he leans on it. Such is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all who depend on him. And if you say to me, we are depending on the Lord our God, isn't he the one whose high places and altars Hezekiah removed, saying to Judah and Jerusalem, you must worship before this altar? Now we first notice in verse 4 that the Rabshakeh says to the Jewish officials, tell Hezekiah, not King Hezekiah. The Rabshakeh doesn't even have the courtesy to call Hezekiah King Hezekiah, as Gil points out. He then mocks Hezekiah. Why are you confident? You say you've got strategy and military strength. That's only empty words. On whom are you depending that you rebel against me? Well, in verse 5, when the Rabshakeh says that Hezekiah is rebelling against the great king, Sennacherib, he's not speaking the truth. Hezekiah had not rebelled. He had paid gold and silver to Sennacherib not to invade. I've already read you 2 Kings 18:14, 6, where Hezekiah gave 11 tons of silver and 1 ton of gold to stop the invasion. And Sennacherib completely ignored it. Now let me quote you from an interesting academic article I found on the internet by a woman named Gail A. Roughlin, and I don't know whether Magdal LaRue is a woman or a man, but these two scholars say this, quote, within the Assyrian royal inscriptions, Hezekiah's tribute to Sennacherib was one of the largest tributes ever received by a monarch, as becomes clear from the survey made by Barr. I don't know what survey these two University of South African scholars are referring to, but some people have done some research on this, and this was a bodaciously large tribute. Now, that might have included tribute after Sennacherib retreated from his invasion of Jerusalem. But at any rate, Hezekiah had paid a lot of money. As I said, he stripped the temple, and this is how he gets repaid. Now, this rebellion of Judah, as alleged by Rabshakeh, is just a pretext for the invasion of Judah. There was no rebellion. It was sheer naked aggression on the part of Assyria. So that's the first lie of the Rabshakeh. In verse 6, he says, now look, you are depending on Egypt. Now, was Hezekiah depending on Egypt? Well, Hezekiah had probably at least contemplated an alliance with Egypt. I can't tell that he actually consummated the alliance. I've looked and looked. Let's read Isaiah 30, verses 1 through 2. Woe to the rebellious children. This is Isaiah speaking. This is the Lord's declaration. They carry out a plan, but not mine. They make an alliance, but against my will, piling sin on top of sin. They set out to go down to Egypt without asking my advice in order to seek shelter under Pharaoh's protection and take refuge in Egypt's shadow. And the they there is talking about officials in Judah, and those officials might not have included Hezekiah. Some people suggest that, so it might not have been Hezekiah. And notice in verse 2, they set out to go down to Egypt. That sounds like they were planning to go, but it doesn't say that they actually went down and consummated that alliance. The Bible in Basic English says that they made a move to go down to Egypt. So I don't know whether the Rabshakeh is telling the truth about Hezekiah here or not, but the Rabshakeh mocks Egypt by saying Egypt is a splintered reed. And if Hezekiah wants to use that splintered reed for a staff, the staff will not hold him up. It will instead poke a hole in his hand and wound him. And Pharaoh does that to all of the people who depend on him, not just Hezekiah, as Isaiah says in verse 6. And in verse 7, the Rabshakeh says, if you say to me, we are depending on the Lord our God, isn't the Lord your God the one whose high places and altars Hezekiah removed? Well, of course Hezekiah didn't remove the altars of Yahweh. The Rabshakeh ignorantly supposed that Hezekiah had removed Yahweh's altars. But Hezekiah had actually removed heathen altars, and the numbskull didn't know the difference. So that's the second lie the Rabshakeh told to the three Jewish officials, that Hezekiah had removed Yahweh's altars from the land of Israel. We go now to Isaiah 36, verses 8 through 10. The Rabshakeh continues, come now, make a bargain with my master, the king of Assyria, that's Sennacherib. I will give you 2,000 horses, if you can put riders on them. How then can you repulse one officer of the least of my master's officials, even though you are depending on Egypt for chariots and horsemen? Furthermore, have I come to attack and destroy this land without the Lord? The Lord himself told me to march against this country and destroy it. Now this bargain that the Rabshakeh wanted to make with Hezekiah could have been a serious offer. I'll give you 2,000 horses, Hezekiah, if you, Hezekiah, will promise to pay tribute and to quit fighting us and become a tributary nation, if you'll stop your so-called rebellion. I don't think so. I think this was a sarcastic offer. The Rabshakeh didn't really mean it. His whole purpose was to mock the Jews. Sennacherib is saying, come on out and fight. If you're too scared to come out and fight, I'll give you horses to help you out. And of course, if I give you horses, you probably don't have enough riders for the horses. I will give you 2,000 horses, he says, if you can put riders on them. Otherwise, they're not going to be of much use to you, are they? He's being sarcastic. In verse 9, he says, how then can you repulse one officer of the least of my master's officials? Well, if we assume that the official is a head of an Assyrian province, he would be a lesser official than the king. And the Rabshakeh is saying, look, even my lesser officials have got more strength, more horses and chariots to knock you out, Hezekiah. How much more so the king of Assyria? And that's true even though you were depending on Egypt. Now, of course, Egypt never sent chariots and horsemen to Hezekiah. He might have been hoping for them and waiting for them. I'm not sure. But the Rabshakeh seems to think that Hezekiah is waiting on help from Egypt. And he's saying, look, even though you're depending on Egypt, it doesn't matter. Even if Egypt sends the horses, you don't have enough horses, even with all the horses that Egypt might supply you. And even if you do have enough horses to defend yourself against us, if you get those horses from Egypt, what good is that going to do? You don't have the men that know how to ride the horses. In other words, Hezekiah, your goose is cooked. You've lost the battle. Submit. Now, in verse 10, the Rabshakeh really puts the cherry on top of the ice cream. Furthermore, have I come to attack and destroy this land without the Lord, without Yahweh? Yahweh himself told me to march against this country and destroy it. Well, that's pretty cheeky, saying that the God of the Hebrews was telling Assyria to attack Israel. Now, how do we handle this? Here's the first option. John Gill says this was just an outright lie. He made it up. And I would have to say it's an arrogant lie at that. Borders on blasphemy. Adam Clark says, option number two, that the way that the Rabshakeh was told to attack Judah was that an apostate Jewish priest probably told Sennacherib to attack. That's Adam Clark's view. Option number three, Jameson Fawcett and Brown say that the Rabshakeh is referring to what Isaiah himself had prophesied about Assyria coming in judgment. Isaiah had said, for example, in Isaiah chapter 10, verses 5 through 6, "Woe to Assyria, the rod of my anger, the staff in their hands is my wrath." In other words, Assyria is God's staff. Assyria belongs to God. God has told Assyria to come wipe out and chasten the people of Judah. In verse 6, Isaiah says, "I will send him, Assyria, against a godless nation, against the Jews. I will command Assyria to go against a people destined for my rage, to take spoils, to plunder, and to trample them down like clay in the streets." Sennacherib perhaps had gotten wind of Isaiah's prophecy somehow and says, "Hey, God's told me to come down here and whack you." Well, of those three options, I think Gil's option is the best, that it's a lie. Rabshakeh is just being arrogant. I don't know how he would have heard about Isaiah's prophecies about Assyria being the instrument that God is going to use to chasten the Jews, and to say an apostate Jewish priest told him that, that's a speculation. I think he's just lying. We go now to Isaiah 36, verses 11 through 12. "Then Eliakim, Shebna, and Joah said to the field commander, to the Rabshakeh, 'Please speak to your servants in Aramaic, since we understand it. Don't speak to us in Hebrew in the hearing of the people on the wall.' But the commander replied, 'Was it only to your master and you that my master sent me to say these things? Was it only to your master, i.e. Hezekiah, and you, you three Jewish officials, that my master, Sennacherib, sent me to say these things, and not to the men sitting on the wall, who, like you, will have to eat their own filth and drink their own urine?'" In verse 11, we've got three people saying to the field commander, and there's one quote. Well, those three people, the three Jewish officials, have one of them speaking for the other two. And that's why it says three people spoke. Obviously, three people didn't speak at the same time. They ask that, very politely, I might add, "Please speak to your servants." They ask that the Rabshakeh speak in Aramaic. Now, Aramaic is the language of Syria. At this time, 8th century B.C., the Jews in Jerusalem were not speaking Aramaic. They were speaking Hebrew. By the time of Jesus, they were speaking Aramaic, but not now. And so the three Jewish officials say to the Rabshakeh, "Please speak in Aramaic. We understand Aramaic. That's a diplomatic language. It's probably the language used most in the East. Don't speak to us in Hebrew where the common people can hear it, the people who are standing at the wall." This is what Albert Barnes says about this. "The Syriac language," that's Aramaic, "was spoken in different parts of Assyria. It was spoken in Mesopotamia and doubtless in some of the provinces of the Assyrian Empire, and might be presumed to be understood by Rabshakeh and those with him. The Jews had contact with the Syrians, and those who had been sent out by Hezekiah had learned to speak Aramaic. It is not probable that they understood the Medo-Persian tongue that was spoken by the Assyrians usually. The Syriac or Aramean was probably the most common language which was spoken in that region. Its knowledge prevailed in the time of the Savior, Aramaic did, and was that which he usually spoke." But that, of course, was later. Now it was the Hebrew language that the people of Jerusalem were speaking. Now in verse 11, the three Jewish officials want Rabshakeh to speak in Hebrew, and you might ask, well, why would an Assyrian diplomat know Hebrew? John Gill says the Assyrian Empire being very large, and so Hebrew had been learned by these courtiers for the sake of negotiation or commerce, when the common people had no concern with it. So it was a diplomatic language as far as the Rabshakeh and the Tartan and the Rabsaris, as far as they were concerned. Now, gauging from the reaction, this looks like a piece of bad policy on the part of the three Jewish officials, because the Rabshakeh absolutely refused to speak in Aramaic, but continued to speak in Hebrew so that the people could understand. So this request backfired on the three Jewish officials. We might ask the question, why would the three Jewish officials do this? Why would they ask for a discussion in Aramaic? Matthew Henry has a good reason. Quote, "While princes and counselors have public matters under debate, it is not fair to appeal to the people. It was a reasonable motion which Hezekiah's plenipotentiaries made, that this parley should be held in a language which the people did not understand. Because reasons of state are secret things and ought to be kept secret, the vulgar being incompetent judges of them. It is therefore an unfair practice, and not doing as men would be done by, to incense subjects against their rulers by base insinuations. Proud and haughty scorners, the fair they are spoken to, commonly speak the fouler. Nothing could be said more mildly and respectfully than that which Hezekiah's agent said to Rabshakeh. Besides that the thing itself was just what they desired, they called themselves his servants. They petitioned for it. Speak, we pray thee, but this made him the more spiteful and imperious. To give rough answers to those who give us soft answers is one way of rendering evil for good. And those are wicked indeed, and it is to be feared incurable with whom that which usually turns away wrath does not make bad worse. Now, Henry is very prolix. He goes on and on and on. And sometimes that gets a little unclear, but basically what he's saying is, it's not proper diplomacy to let the common folks get involved in that diplomacy. But of course, the Rabshakeh, what he's trying to do, he's trying to get the people of Israel, who are going to be hungry, they're going to be drinking urine pretty soon, eating dung. He wants them to put pressure on the leaders of Jerusalem so that the leaders of Jerusalem will capitulate. And notice that although the scripture says in the New Testament a soft answer turns away wrath, wasn't true in this case. Soft answer did not turn away wrath at all. Now notice the three Jewish officials said at the end of verse 11 that the people were on the wall, in the hearing of the people on the wall. They can hear, so they know what's going on. So the Rabshakeh in verse 12 replies and he says, hey, I didn't just come down here to talk to Hezekiah. I came down here to speak to these men sitting on the wall. And by the way, these guys are going to have to be eating their own excrement and drinking their own urine fairly shortly. Bad news for the three Jewish officials. Now in verse 12, the Rabshakeh says that the men sitting on the wall, as well as the three Jewish commissioners, are going to have to drink their own urine. Now for urine, the King James has pissed. Now I've got an interesting quote from John Gill. The Jews have substituted other words in the margin instead of those in the text is more cleanly and less offensive. For dung, they put excrement, and for piss, they read the waters of the feet. And had we in our version put excrement and urine instead of these words, it would have been more decent. Oh, I don't think so. I think you ought to put the words in there to show how horrible it was going to be without being profane about it. You're going to have to eat your own doo-doo. How about that? Your own filth, as the NIV has it, but it's talking about excrement. And when the King James uses the word piss, Gill implies that that's not very decent. I've actually used that against somebody who was flirting with King James only. And I told him, I said, I'm sorry, I'm just not going to let my kids use a Bible translation that has the word piss in it. He couldn't believe me that the word piss was in there. Oh, yes, it is. It's in there several times, actually. We go now to Isaiah 36, verses 13 through 17. Then the Rabshakeh stood and called out in Hebrew, so everybody could understand it, including the common people in Jerusalem. Hear the words of the great king, the king of Assyria. That's Sennacherib. This is what the king says. Do not let Hezekiah deceive you. He cannot deliver you. Do not let Hezekiah persuade you to trust in the Lord when he says, the Lord will surely deliver us. This city will not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria. Do not listen to Hezekiah. This is what the king of Assyria says. Make peace with me and come out to me. Then every one of you will eat from his own vine and fig tree and drink water from his own cistern. Until I come and take you to a land like your own, a land of grain and new wine, a land of bread and vineyards. How could the people of Jerusalem resist the dulcet tones of this Assyrian ambassador? Now the Rabshakeh says that Hezekiah has been telling the people the Lord will surely deliver us. Now, why might Hezekiah say that the Lord will surely deliver us with great confidence? Well, because God had promised to defend and deliver Jerusalem through Isaiah. Isaiah 31, verse 5. Like hovering birds, so the Lord of hosts will protect Jerusalem. By protecting it, he will rescue it. By sparing it, he will deliver it. And also in Isaiah 38, 6. God says, and I will deliver you and this city from the power of the king of Assyria. I will defend this city. So the Rabshakeh perhaps knew about these prophecies. I don't know how he would know about Isaiah and his prophecies, but the Rabshakeh is stating that Hezekiah is telling the people that God's going to deliver us. He might have just assumed that. But at any rate, the Rabshakeh says, don't listen to Hezekiah. I've got something better for you than what Hezekiah's got. If you'll make peace and come out to me, you can eat from your own vine as opposed to eating your own doo-doo. If we besiege the city, if we continue to besiege the city, and you can, instead of eating doo-doo, you can eat from your own vine and fig tree. You'll have your own little farm, and you'll grow your own little vineyard, and you'll have fig trees. And you'll drink water from your own cistern instead of drinking your own piss, your own urine. But you'll have a cistern. You'll have a little farm. Verse 17, until I come and take you to a land like your own. Ah, now the Rabshakeh has got to admit that the Assyrians, as usual, when they conquer a place, they take the population and spread them out all over creation, all over the Assyrian Empire. So he can't get around that, but he's trying to make them think that it's going to be so pleasant. This new land, when we take you out into exile, will be a land of grain and new wine, a land of bread and vineyards. I doubt the people of Israel fell for that. Where would this land be? Well, it could be in Africa, it could be in Media and northern Iran, who knows? But whatever land that the Rabshakeh might name, he could never name any place equal to the land of Canaan. That was a land flowing with milk and honey. Why would they want to leave that? Of course, they're hungry now. They're in a siege. So the blandishment might be a little more effective because they were so hungry. We go now to Isaiah 36, verses 18 through 20. The Rabshakeh continues, do not let Hezekiah mislead you when he says, the Lord will deliver us. Has the God of any nation ever delivered his land from the hand of the king of Assyria? Where are the gods of Hamath and Arpad? Where are the gods of Sepharvaim? Have they rescued Samaria from my hand? Who of all the gods of these countries has been able to save his land from me? How then can the Lord deliver Jerusalem from my hand? Now Rabshakeh is bragging about all the cities that have been conquered by the Assyrians, and there were a lot of them, and every city had their local god, and every one of them had failed to protect their city. So why should Hezekiah think his little old local god called Yahweh could protect Jerusalem? Well, as John Gill says, that Rabshakeh is blasphemously setting the Lord God of Israel upon a level with the fictitious gods of the Gentiles. Now, if you think about it, the Rabshakeh's logic was pretty good. If God was like all the other little local gods of all the other Gentile nations, because Assyria had beaten them all, well, that means that Assyria is likely going to beat the local god of Judah. But the problem with that is that Yahweh is not a mere local god. He's the God that created the whole universe. Now, some of the cities who have been conquered, Hamath, that's a city in Syria. Arphad is also in Syria, connected with Hamath. Sepharvaim, John Gill says, is a city in Syro-Phoenicia, which is to the north, maybe northeast of Israel, but I think Jameson Fawcett Brown's got a closer approximation to where this city is. Nobody knows for sure. Those commentators say now Sephara on the east of Euphrates above Babylon. It was a just retribution. Israel worshipped the gods of Sepharvaim, and so colonists of Sepharvaim were planted in the land of Israel, thenceforth called Samaria, by the Assyrian conqueror. I'm going to read a verse in 2 Kings 17:24, which will show that the Assyrians effected a population swap between the citizens of Samaria, the capital of northern Israel, in 722 BC. Those citizens were carried to Sepharvaim, and the citizens of Sepharvaim were sent back to Samaria. We read that in 2 Kings 17:24. Then the king of Assyria brought people from Babylon, Cuthah, Avah, Hamath, and Sepharvaim, and settled them in place of the Israelites in the cities of Samaria. The settlers took possession of Samaria and lived in its cities. Earlier I said the city of Samaria. It's actually the province of Samaria, which had a bunch of cities in it. The population was carried from Sepharvaim. Now, BibleAtlas.org has Sepharvaim on the Tigris River north of Opus, which would put it to the northeast of Babylon, which is on the Euphrates. Gill says that the city was in Syro-Phoenicia, which is not where BibleAtlas.org has it. BibleAtlas.org has a question mark by it because they don't know where it is either. Jameson Fawcett and Brown says it's not on the Tigris, but it's on the Euphrates right north of Babylon. Who knows? Here's some other interesting facts about this place of Sepharvaim. This is from Wikipedia, which was using Easton's Bible Dictionary. Sepharvaim was taken by a king of Assyria, probably Sargon II. It was a double city and received the common name Sepharvaim, the two Sepharas, or the two book towns. The Sepharah on the east bank of the Euphrates is now called Abu Habba. That on the other bank was Akkad, the old capital of Sargon I, where he established a great library. Sargon I was an Akkadian king way back in history. Sepharvaim was the center of the worship of the god Adrammelech. They also worshiped the god Anammelech. After the deportation of the Israelite tribes, at least some of the residents of this city were brought to Samaria to repopulate it with other Gentile settlers. Now at the end of verse 19, the Rabshakeh says, "Have they, the gods of all these places like Sepharvaim, Hamath, and Arpad, have they rescued Samaria, the northern kingdom, from my hand?" Well, actually, Sennacherib had not really knocked out the northern kingdom, Samaria. That had been done by his predecessors, Sargon II, his first predecessor, and then behind him, before him, was Shalmaneser V. And so the Rabshakeh is making Sennacherib brag about cities that had been attacked by himself personally when it was actually his predecessor, Assyrian kings. We go now to Isaiah 36, verses 21 through 22. "But the people remained silent and said nothing in reply, because the king had commanded, 'Do not answer him.' Then Eliakim, son of Hilkiah, the palace administrator, Shebna, the secretary, and Joah, son of Asaph, the recorder, went to Hezekiah with their clothes torn and told him what the field commander had said." Now the NIV in verse 21 says, "But the people remained silent." All my other translations have, "They remain silent," which means that they could refer to the people or it could refer to the three Jewish commissioners, Eliakim, Shebna, and Joah. Well, since most of the translations have "they" and the most logical referent to that indefinite pronoun "they" would be the three Jewish commissioners, we would say the three Jewish officials remain silent. However, if we read in the historical version, 2 Kings 18:36, all the translations of that verse have "people." For example, the Young's Literal Translation in 2 Kings 18:36, "And the people have kept silent and not answered him a word, for the command of the king is saying, 'Do not answer him.'" Well, whoever it was, whether the people or the three Jewish officials, they could have easily refuted Rabshakeh. After all, saying that Hezekiah had torn down the altars to Yahweh, how absurd that was. They could have easily refuted Rabshakeh, but they didn't, because of the king's command. But why did Hezekiah not want the Rabshakeh answered? Well, a couple of options. One is, there's no point in answering a fool. As Matthew Henry says, "It is sometimes prudent not to answer a fool according to his folly. Hezekiah's command was, 'Answer him not. It will but provoke him to rail and blaspheme yet more and more. Leave it to God to stop his mouth, for you cannot.'" They had reason enough on their side, but it would be hard to speak it to such an unreasonable adversary without a mixture of passion. And if they should fall a railing like him, Rabshakeh would be much too hard for them at that weapon. In other words, the three Jewish officials might get into a shouting match with the three Assyrian officials, and that would not go well for Hezekiah and Jerusalem. Well, that's the first reason, perhaps, why Hezekiah did not want the Rabshakeh answered. No point in stirring up the wrath of a fool. But the other reason might be that Hezekiah did not want for common people to enter into diplomacy, if indeed he told the common people not to answer too. It's not really clear. Now we have another issue. When did the king command, "Don't answer the Rabshakeh"? Well, I assume that he told the three Jewish officials before they went out to the wall. Hezekiah, being aware that the three officials would be rude and insolent and blaspheming, and so he's saying, "Don't answer them." Or maybe Hezekiah is saying, "Listen to what he wants, but don't answer him. You come back and tell me, then I'll decide what we're going to do." Now, if indeed Hezekiah had told the common people not to answer, then one of his reasons might have been he didn't think the common people should be engaged in high-level diplomacy. So just to summarize all this, why did the king not want the Rabshakeh answered? Option number one, no point in answering a fool and get him all upset. He might come down hard on us. Option number two, it's not proper for common people to enter into diplomacy. Option number three, Hezekiah wanted to hear the terms that the Rabshakeh was offering and make the decision himself on how to respond. He didn't want his diplomats, if you will, the Jewish officials, making the decision prematurely. Now, the king was not at the wall when the negotiation was going on, so we asked the question, well, when had the king commanded either the people or the three Jewish officials or both of them? When did the king command them to not answer? Probably when he sent the three Jewish officials out to the wall. He might have been aware that the Rabshakeh would behave in a rude, insolent, and blaspheming manner, and he says, don't talk with these people. Or it could have been he did not want to give his officials authority to treat with the enemy. He wanted to make the decision himself as to what to do. So he's just sending them out there and saying, listen to what they have to say, but don't answer them. Don't agree to anything. And notice, whoever he told to be quiet, either the people or the three Jewish officials, he could have told both of them before he sent the three Jewish officials out to the wall. Now, when the three Jewish officials heard the harsh terms, they tore their clothes, which, of course, is the standard way that you show that you're very sad and upset. John Gill says this was done perhaps not in the presence and within the sight of Rabshakeh, but as they came along, and that partly account of the blasphemies they had heard, and partly through the grief of heart for the distressing calamity they might fear were coming on themselves, their king, their city, and country. In other words, they were toast, and they knew it. They knew they were going to die, or that Judah would go down and become a province of Assyria at best. And John Gill suggests maybe they were tearing their clothes because they heard Yahweh blasphemed when he was brought down to the level of a local tutelary god. And so, ladies and gentlemen, on that very sad note, we have now finished Isaiah chapter 36, and we are now ready to go to the next chapter, chapter 37. I'm probably only going to do the first 20 verses of that chapter, and I will entitle that section, Hezekiah Seeks Isaiah's Help. I hope you stay tuned for the discussion of the next section of Scripture, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.